Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart podcast.
A 30-year-old airplane will help solve a 30-year-old mystery as it's flown by a 30-year-old schoolteacher. Mrs. Ann Pellegrino of Michigan, along with a co-pilot, navigator, and mechanic, will duplicate Amelia Earhart's flight of 1937. Mrs. Pellegrino, a former aviation instructor, will take 5 weeks to fly from Oakland across South America, Africa, India, New Guinea, Hawaii, and back to Oakland.
In 1967, project guest and aviation icon Ann Hultgren Pellegrino became the first to complete Amelia Earhart's ambitious world flight in a Lockheed 10 Electra. In 2017, on the 50th anniversary of her world flight, Ann gave a special reflective presentation in Atchison, Kansas, at the Atchison Public Library during the Amelia Earhart Festival. Chasing Earhart cameras caught it on film. Tonight, we take you back to 2017 in Atchison, Kansas, as Episode 71 continues our Icon series, with both a regular audio release of the podcast and, for the first time ever, a very special audio-video version of the podcast presented exclusively on our YouTube channel. Listen in as Ann takes us back to 1967 to bring us along the World Flight Trail.
Okay, what is this?
It's an Electra.
Okay, it's a Lockheed 10. The date is 1961, December. And this is a plane I flew around the world.
Wow.
And it had a belly landing problem, and it was stripped, bought, and stripped, and everything taken out, propellers, engines, anything in it, and they were going to burn it. But the gentleman that's second from the left there coming towards you is Lee Koepke. He's an A1 mechanic. If he says it's go, I wouldn't even inspect it. And he bought the airplane, dragged it to his little Quonset hut on the airport. He lived in a big house right on the airport in a little Quonset hut. And for 4 years, no air conditioning in the summer, no heat in the winter, he rebuilt this airplane to that.
Wow. That's gorgeous.
And by the summer of 1966, he had it flying. Now, this is actually in March of 67. There's still snow on the ground up at Willow Run Airport near Ypsilanti. And Lee had talked to me in 1962, and I barely had a private license. And he was the IA who signed off our Cessna 140 we had, my husband and I. And he's sitting out, and we're sitting at Willow Run Airport, little grass strip. And he says, I'm rebuilding an airplane. Well, what kind? Oh, it's the kind Earhart was flying on her last flight. I said, oh, really? I wasn't even sure about what it was then. I just had a private license. And he said, well, you know, 1967 is the 30th anniversary of her flight. And I said, yeah? And he said, why don't you think about flying it around the world? And I said, surely. I had flown from Ann Arbor, Michigan to Rockford, Illinois and back. And I had like 120 hours. But my husband said he'll never get it done. So we went home, kind of forgot. And then in November of 66, by that time I had stopped teaching English. I was a full-time flight instructor, charter, teaching all the ground schools. I wrote them all. And I was with a student at Willow Run, and I looked down and I said, that's not a Twin Beach. That's Lee's Lockheed, you know? And so I think he didn't really think it would happen. He wanted to fly around the world and prove it wasn't the airplane, you know. So, okay. So anyway, Don gave me Fred Gerner's book, The Search for Amelia Earhart, for Christmas. And I read it. And in like early 1967, right after New Year's, I said, you know, this is the year to do it if we're going to do it. So Don says, well, if you want to do it, it's your thing, but if you need me, I'll help. So I called Lee and I went over and talked to him. It was a cold, starry, clear night. I drove over to see Lee and we sat at his dining room table and his wife is there and we talked. He said, well, that's what I thought you came over about. And meanwhile, I had gone and sat in the air, you know, I'd done little things and so forth. And he said, well, he said, you know, we could try it. Yeah, I said, we could try it, Lee, and if we do the best we can and still fail, we've done our best, you know. And his wife said, well, when I married him, I knew he was crazy. So, anyway, we decided to try. Hi, doggie. And so, we started asking. And of course, here we talk to people, we're two nobodies, an IA doesn't even have a private license yet, and somebody who has a private, well, by then by 66, I had my commercial multi-engine flight instructor and all those good things, you know, and I had flown Twin Beaches some, and other lucky, you know, other twin airplanes with nose wheels. And so, anyway, we started asking. I never knew there were so many ways to say no, politely or not. Pratt & Whitney said no, and Lockheed didn't want us to go because they'd already lost Wiley Post, Putnam. They didn't want to lose Pellegrino too, I think. So finally, one day, we went over and talked to Bill Polemus in Ann Arbor. And he was the most optimistic guy I ever knew. By the end of the day, Lee and I had borrowed for us from Collins Radio a 618 T3HF. We couldn't afford it. It was my shoestring, you know. We didn't have any money. We both taught school. And he had arranged for Colesman periscopic sextants. We had state-of-the-art 67 equipment. Earhart had state-of-the-art plus for 1937. And the later people who flew had state-of-the-art for that year, and I don't blame them. They should. And so the end of the day, Lee and I felt encouraged. And he'd wanted the specs on the airplane and everything. And from the very beginning, when I walked in there, he wanted to go. I knew that. And he said, Bill, you kind of want to go, don't you? He says, yeah. Well, let me tell you, he says, you know, you don't have a lot of experience out of the country. I said, no, none. And he says, I have a friend. And he's the guy that flew the B-58 speed run from Washington to Paris in 1961. He got the Harmon Trophy in 1962. And he's just great. He's flown, you know, all the stuff. He was at Edwards. He was everywhere. And just a really talented guy. So we wrote the Secretary of the Air Force. He was on active duty in the Pentagon and said, Dear Mr. Brown, we'd like to borrow Bill Payne for a month to fly around the world in a 30-year-old airplane for a very historical flight. And we got permission. So Bill was aboard. That guy was uncanny. I mean, the whole crew, we were just, I think, maybe the only four people then that could have done it. It just worked out. And everything on the flight worked out to get us to Howland Island exactly 30 years later. It was just amazing the things that happened, the good for us. And one of the things we had to do was get fuel tanks. So I flew the plane to Wichita, and we always flew with a second pilot because the pilots that had dumped this had the gear, they put a guard on it. You had to pull the guard down, then work the gear lever, and you had to take your hands off the control yoke. So we always had a second pilot, and in case anything went wrong, we had no autopilot, nothing. So we had to hand fly it all the time in a single pilot. You couldn't have left the seat. So we always flew with somebody else in the plane. And that was good. They enjoyed flying this old airplane around. And that's the reason, even if she crashed somewhere, she would have survived. That's the main spar. It's built like the Brooklyn Bridge. It's a tough, well-built airplane. Really tough. So it was in Wichita for 3 weeks with Dave Blanton, and he put in these beautiful fuel tanks. And he put an oil transfer system in the nose because those engines are made to burn a certain amount of oil. And there was a crank for each engine, 58 turns of the crank, put 1 quart of oil in that engine. You know, and everybody thinks you just sit there and look outside. No, there's lots of little things to do on a world flight plane. And then we finally got it back. We had more total fuel capacity than a DC-3. We were a ton and a half overweight when we took off on our heavy legs. And at each side were a bank of four electric fuel pumps, and they pumped those into the main tanks on the wings. And they worked very, very well. The whole system worked perfectly. That airplane had no faults. It ran well the whole time. You pushed a switch, it worked. Lee was a master at this. He really was good. That's the cockpit. King Radio gave us some 720 things and ADF, a wonderful ADF. And those car door handles underneath there, those are what you crank the oil in with. And there's the switch on the gear. You had to pull that thing lever down, and then you could work the gear switch up and down, which was a good thing. I sat on 4 inches of foam and had 4 inches behind me, but you do what you gotta do, and it worked. That's a standard cockpit for a Lockheed 10 of that era, but with modern, more modern radios on it. This is the first time I met Bill Payne. He came over to test the fuel dump system, which they had also put in Wichita. We found that we had to fly 10 minutes to get the weight down to where a single engine would handle our regular weight, we get it down. So that was the test. And the little boy there is 12 years old, and that's Lee's oldest son. And I mean, the families were involved, and it was just and everybody at the hangar, they gave us free hangar space there at the airport to work inside. Everybody helped, and they all came Friday afternoon because I made a homemade German chocolate cake and took it over, so they all worked on Friday. And those are a couple guys who helped. That's Bill Palimas, Bill Payne, Lee Kepke, and Jeff. And I just talked to him a month ago and found out a lot of things about the plane and everything I didn't know. This is the day that we took off. Finally, we were ready. We just kept installing things, and people kept working on the radios. They built radio racks. I mean, we had virtually a round-the-clock workhouse on this airplane from March until we left on June 7th. And these are all the newsmen. But you know, around the world, we were always met by the media, except at Kupang and Jakarta, those places. But newsmen spoke English, and if we needed something, they knew where to get it. So I've always had a soft spot in my heart for newsmen. And the old B cameras, and that's my 1966 Valiant in the background. I had to get a loan on it for $4,000, which is more than it was worth, from a friendly bank to pay our insurance with Lloyd's of London. Wow. I mean, goodness, we're using Lloyd's of London. We must be doing something dangerous. And so, but that was for the crew. Bill Palimas had 10 kids. Lee Kepke had 4, Bill Payne had 3, and we didn't have any. I just had Don. But it was life insurance. There was no hull insurance on that airplane ever, just liability. And Lee trusted us to take it around the world safely and bring it back.
Wow.
You know, it was a leap of miracles, everything. So we did take off that morning in the rain, and we started flying off to California to start at Oakland and then onward. We got to California. That's Fred Gerner. I'd read his book. And he and I talked. We didn't agree on everything, but we talked, had a wonderful visit. And then we went across the country to Miami, basically. And that's where we departed the country. And we flew down to Puerto Rico, Venezuela, Caracas, and on to Natal. And that's where we hopped over the Atlantic. The Atlantic was our first really big, long flight. And it was a grass strip. It was night. You know, we took off. And this runway, you couldn't see the other end. It was sloping up, you know. So we pushed the throttles forward, and away we went. That is the drift meter. Now, Noonan had a handheld drift meter. This is a gyro-stabilized drift meter. My husband and I and another guy flew over to Benton Harbor. We spent the whole afternoon in a warehouse digging through dusty, dusty drift meters to find one that was short enough that wouldn't drag on the ground. And we finally found one, and it was installed. And Bill knew how to use everything. He was a crackerjack. He was the Fred Noonan of 1967. That man is amazing. And I believe Fred was a crackerjack guy in 37. I would have gone anywhere with Fred, you know, and Bill, you know. We took off from Natal at night. and flew all night. There's the intertropical zone of thunderstorms and lightning and St. Elmo's fire ringing the propellers. Beautiful, fluorescent blue. We were going up, we were going down. There was lightning. It was very exciting. That airplane didn't leak a drop. That's amazing for a 30-year-old airplane. Some of the modern ones can't even do that. But as we couldn't go, we couldn't get any sighting because of the storms, no astrocytes. So we kept going because we figured Africa was pretty hard to miss. And when we got there, we were south of course. We had to go almost directly north for 90 miles, but we had no way of knowing. And from Africa, we were going to go across it, but the Arab-Israeli war, the State Department canceled our clearances, and we couldn't go south, uprisings in the Congo. But we, in Dakar, we landed on a Friday afternoon. Well, their phone lines go through France, they go through every player, and we couldn't get a line. And we had to talk to Kitty Hauser at AOPA. She had arranged all our clearances, and she was a genius of a woman for doing that. And so we couldn't call her, so I went and bought stamps for the flight covers. These were arranged ahead of time, and I went and got the stamps. And then I went to the airport and kind of said, would you like to lick some stamps? I had four or five people helping lick stamps, but we did get it done. And my crew flew the plane and talked using the HF. I could talk to my husband in 10 minutes. Just call. We were on a military network because of Bill Payne, and I'd call Andrews or the Radio Shack at Collins. They'd put a phone patch through, and I could talk to my husband in 10 minutes. It was amazing and clear as heck. And any 99s here who were in Washington, they heard us broadcast from near Howland. That's a little later. So anyway, my crew talked to Kitty. She arranged the clearances for us to go up to Portugal and Italy and Turkey, Tehran. And at Karachi, we were back on the Earhart Trail again. But modern tech thing, that was state-of-the-art 3067. We could do that, get new clearances that quickly through Kitty. And I never met her. And there's so many people that helped us I never met. But they were there. And I thanked them all. You know, that was part of it. And then we flew to Delhi and Calcutta, down to Bangkok, Singapore, and Jakarta, and the little island of Timor, which is just off the map there. And, you know, we got up in the morning and we were all ready to go. It was a new day, and we kept going because we wanted to be over Howland 30 years later. So it was anywhere from 8 to 18 hours of flying, and Lee took total care of the airplane. Bill did the flight planning. I mean, I knew nothing about this stuff, and I dealt with the media and got the food and got anything else we had to do, took care of myriad things that we did. That's Bill. This was a tiring flight. Those engines, they took out all the soundproofing, so we wore earplugs to save weight, you know, 6 pounds gasoline. And so we wore earplugs over our very primitive headsets. And this is one I caught of him napping. And I told him when we started, you know, I had 15 hours PIC in the plane when we started. I said, Bill, anytime you want to take over, just do it. Just do it, you know? He was excellent. When he came to check out in the airplane, Lee says, do you want me to go with you? He says, nope. Bill gets in the plane, starts the engines. He's never flown one of these before. He's flown C-45s and stuff sooner. Starts the engines, and these are all different instruments. He gets in, takes off at Willow Run. 15 minutes later, he came back and landed and said, I'll go. That's a real compliment to Lee and everything. Now, we were going to go across Africa, a tropical flight, but we were diverted. And when we went over the mountains, Turkey and all in that area, it was cold. We were 15, 16,000 feet, no oxygen. Remember, we were going equatorial, and it was cold. And it was freezing there. And Lee was under his blanket in the navigator seat because Bill Polimas had taken the airlines back to Ann Arbor to be with his company for a week, and then he met us in Singapore. See, a wonder of 1967. And I sat with my feet in the sun. I had everything on I had brought. And it was still cold. It was still cold. Now, when we landed in Singapore, one of the nice things about going 30 years later, there are people around who whose parents had known Earhart, and some people there who had actually met Earhart Noonan. It was wonderful, you know, to talk with these people that had been there. And they had touched Amelia, they touched Fred, you know, it's just wonderful. And this is Roy Norris, and his father, she had landed at Seletar Air Force Base in Singapore, and his father had helped fuel Amelia. And just incredible people that we met in every country. It was really super. But there's Lee fueling it. He took care of the oil, the fueling. And, I mean, we got in that airplane, we knew it was good to go. That is the airstrip at Kupang, a little island. First we chased a horse off that was grazing. And we had flown from Jakarta along Bali, you know, Bali High, my navigator was singing. And finally we get there and it's very close to sunset. And you know in the tropics it's light and then it's dark, you know, right away. So we landed and they came out. They said, well, the gas man's gone home. So they finally got the gas man. And we put on a show for him because it was from barrels. Lee's up on the wing, he slid off once, and they all, you know, it was a hilarious time. And then to pay for it, they wouldn't take our shell carnet. Now, my navigator's parents in California knew Jimmy Doolittle, and Jimmy Doolittle was Shell Oil Company. So Shell Oil Company gave us a shell carnet to credit card. For our gas, I don't know how we would have paid for it. Our funding was very, very minimal. And when I'm doing my book, 50th Anniversary Edition now, I'm going to tell you what the funding was. It was just barely $15,000, $16,000 we had. And everything else we paid for. And after the flight, I worked a year and a half to pay for all the bills, lecturing, writing, everything. But it was worth it, you know. Everybody helped. And the friends I met, even around the world, you know, I still think of them. Anyway, so finally they got the bill paid, and it's dark. So we get in and we taxi out to the end of the runway. And see those hills? We had to take off that way because there are hills here too. So, you know, the whole game, you rev the engines, hold the brakes. And when it's shaking like it wants to go, it goes. And when it's heavy, it takes forever to get the tail up. Tail comes up. As soon as we're breaking ground, then we're heading gently toward the ocean. We didn't want to go over the hills. And we landed at Darwin. That's not Darwin. We landed at Port Darwin and we had fresh milk. Oh, was that good. We stayed overnight. And then the next day we had people coming out from the Australian and that area. You know, their FAA and the people that somebody was there, one of the guys that had been there. And we just, we could have, like, after the talk today, a lot of you will want to talk to me. That's what happened all the time. And so we were often late taking off, just talking with people. But, you know, we wanted to share everything. Now, then we went to Port Moresby, where we got a wreath to throw it on Howland. Beautiful, beautiful wreath. And then we took off for Ley, New Guinea, and we went over the mountains and down. Now that's the 1937 photo. That's the runway Earhart used. Backs up into the hills, it's 3,000 feet of sod. And there's another similar runway in that area that also had sod, and there's stories about that that we'll probably hear later sometime. But that's the town of Ley, New Guinea. In 1967, the runway was paved. 5,800 feet. There's still a drop off into the Huon Gulf there. So we circled. Could somebody get me a glass of water? Jack Daniels, water, Budweiser. What?
I have a Diet Dr. Pepper.
Closer to the screen.
What?
Closer to the screen so we can get you in the light, you're in the shadow.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Would you like a Diet Dr. Pepper?
No, I'll just take water. And so we flew around, and then Bill Payne on these occasions, he wanted to do his runway scraping buzz job. So believe me, I tucked up my feet and I said, okay. And he was so good, he just did it. And then I landed and I bounced in front of all those people that had come. Three times. But I recovered it. And there's what it looks like. 1-4, right? That's the Huon Gulf there. If you're not off the ground, you're in the water. 20 girls had walked down from a technical school in Ley to say hello, and I was showing them the wreath. And I really wish I had all their addresses. I'd like to know what happened to them in these 50 years in Ley, New Guinea. I often think about the people I met, where they are now, if they're still with us and everything, because they were so special. You know, and I remember them all. This is Bertie Heath. He was a pilot, and he flew up to the mines at Bulolo, the gold mines. And he witnessed Earhart's takeoff. And he said that when she took off, he was coming in from a trip, and he watched, and she was so low over the Huon Gulf, her propellers were throwing spray.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, well, we knew that, and we were taking off. But he and I had a nice chat, and about 3 or 4 years ago, Paul Harvey did the rest of the story talking about Bertie Heath and me and everything, and it was just very exciting. Now, from Le Nouguinne, we flew to Nauru and then Howland's over there, just east of the international dateline. We had enough fuel to go to Howland, 2,600 miles, but there's no longer a runway there. And going over to the Phoenix Islands, that's a little too dicey. It's a little too, you know, not enough fuel. So we landed at Nauru, and then we overflew Howland, and then we landed at Canton, and then up to Honolulu, and back to the States. That's the landing strip on Nauru, another dirt strip. And it was nearing sunset, and landed, and we had a wonderful dinner and a cold shower. It felt so good. And then we went back to the airport. But before we landed, the whole island came to see us, I think. And it was administered by the Australians then. And that's the guy in the khaki shorts. He's the Australian guy. And we had tucked a few away, a few little pints of whiskey. And we used one of them there because you're not supposed to take off at night. But they agreed to let us take off at night because we had to take off at a time to be over Howland Island, like 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. So we did. And my crew, they got floral crowns of frangipani. And they were such good sports. We all wore them. And we have an EAA symbol on the door there. That was the thing we had. And a champion spark plug. That's all we had because we really wanted a plain silver airplane like Amelia's. And that was our goal, to be make the commemorative flight for Amelia. And that was it. Nothing else. We took off. There were flare pots along the runway. Some of you are old enough to remember the little oil flare pots along the construction zones, flickering light, kerosene. And they had that lining on the runway. And we also knew there were wild pigs. We'd seen them driving into dinner. And they said, well, we'll go to the other end of the runway, and if we flick our lights 3 times, there were no wild pigs that we saw on the runway. So, you know, hold the brakes, rev the throttles, and pretty soon you're moving very slowly. The tail comes up, and then you're off. You're over the water. There's no horizon, so you're on instruments right away. Slow climb on course to Howland. Now, we were kind of navigating based on her saying 157337, the line of position. We were kind of using that because we had nothing else to use then. And so you don't want to head right to the island, because if you get there and it's not there, you don't know which way to turn. So about 40 miles out, we turned about 30-40 degrees off to the left, so that when we reached the line of position, we'd be reasonably sure we could turn to 157 and fly down to Howland. So that's what we did. There he's using the Colson Periscopic Sextitute periscope, and we're all wearing overwater harnesses that had parachutes for life rafts. Thank goodness we didn't have to use them, courtesy of the Air Force. And he was such an excellent navigator. He was the navigator on Bill Payne's B-58 speed run to Paris. So I had the whole team. It was just great. And then the back, that's the radio rack there. And then heading back to the thing, okay. Then he would plot, and people built that nav station. They built this board. Guys, they just came in. My husband and all our EAA friends and others built all these parts for the airplane and installed them. And we did this between like March and June 7th, and the plane was away for 3 weeks. I mean, I'm sitting there, whoa, what's going on here? When we turned down the line, we would be reasonably sure Howland would be right ahead of us. Instead, we had these squalls. Well, we didn't know if the island were underneath. We couldn't go over on top. We couldn't see the island. So we're flying around the Pacific. We decided, well, we couldn't see it. So Bill started a search pattern, first to the north, kind of, then to the northeast, kind of, then southwest, and back and forth. And finally, that's what we saw. Finally, through a break in the clouds, Lee said, I think I saw an island. And it's so fitting that Lee saw it. It was his idea, his airplane, and he found it. Yeah. And that's Howland from about 5 miles away. You know, it was out in the clear, and so we flew closer. That's Howland Island.
Oh my God.
It's about, you know, 8 feet high, 8-9 feet high, and it's a half mile wide and a mile and a half long. It's a tiny bit of sawed-off mountaintop. You cannot see it from a great distance. The Canary Islands, the mountains stuck up. You know, you could really see them in a distance. And that's what I saw for like 260 hours when I was in the plane. That wonderful left engine. Those engines didn't miss a beat. They sounded better over water, as a matter of fact. We only had time, since we'd taken all that time searching for it, to fly around a couple times and take some photos. And then Bill Payne took over and flew low over the island. I went back to the door. I got the wreath. And Lee held the door open with his foot and really held onto me tight. And we put the wreath out. And I think hopefully it landed where another pair of Lockheed 10 wheels should have landed 30 years ago. You know, you always hope that. And then we flew on to Canton. And then we flew up to Hawaii. At that time, we had our sponsors, people who helped us paint it on the airplane. The tires were bad on the plane. Goodyear Tire and Rubber gave us a pair like 10 days before we were going to leave. It was our last pair of air wheels. And we got them. They gave them to us. Champions Park Plug had given us 36 iridium plugs and $1,000 that we didn't have to give back if we didn't make it. You know, we had all sorts of these things. And it's just, when I do my book, I'm going to mention, you know, what really, these things that we got when we needed them, it was amazing. And you'd ask and they would say no, and it would come, you know. And so we had Lays, and that's the four of us. We're ready to take off for California. And there's that good old 79237, ready to go. That airplane always looked poised and just ready to go. Of course, all Lockheed 10s and 12s look like they want to fly. They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. 18 hours later, we landed at Oakland. And we landed on the same runway we had departed from. And everyone was there to greet us. And we were happy. Happy to be home, that we'd made the flight. Lee was happy that he'd proven that it wasn't the airplane that did Amelia in, that made Amelia get lost and gone. Then we flew to Newton, Kansas. And I didn't meet a lot of 99s around because they were in Newton, Kansas. That's where the convention was this year, or Wichita, somewhere close. I met some there. And they had a parade, and my husband flew the three wives down from Michigan. And they had a little parade, and we went, and I got to meet Muriel Morrissey. And what a nice lady. I'll tell you something, though, we never, ever talked about the mystery. There was just a tacit thing. We never mentioned it. We just were friends. And I loved the lady. And she gave me a four-leaf clover. She said, well, Anne, I looked for a four-leaf clover. I couldn't find one. But all I could find was this dogwood. And it's pewter. It's silver. It's beautiful. And I said, well, Muriel, that's a beautiful four-leaf clover. So I had my four-leaf clover. I gave her one of the roses that I had been given in Oakland. And we had been friends and written back and forth. And she has been a marvel in terms of continuing Amelia's presence here and saying the right things, giving speeches. I've seen her stand, just a brave lady, telling about Amelia and the flight and her life too. And I'm so glad we have an airplane named Muriel. Grace, are you here? And I think that's just a tremendous thing to have that airplane here and to have Grace here to tell about it and be with it. That's going to be a real, real special thing. And I went out and saw it today, and it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. Anyway, we had a good chat, and they had a dinner for us that night. They had a reviewing stand, and that's Ray King, Representative Ray King of Kansas, very forward-looking, neat guy. He came to Detroit a couple of Willow Run to see us off and later and give us wheat to carry around the world, Kansas wheat. We carried Kansas wheat. And on the dining room table in the birthplace home was that those kernels of wheat encased in plastic. There's one complete circle, one incomplete. One is Amelia's, and one is mine. And there were 17 of them made, and one of his daughters gave me hers, which will be given appropriately when it's time to give. And so, anyway, there's Morrissey in her blue flowered skirt, and my husband and me, and my crew was sitting this way. And Newton was so welcoming. And one of my students I had taught in seventh grade English was there. So I said, oh, come on, you can come eat with us at the dinner. Just come on. So we stayed there that night. The wives came down, and my husband was there, and we just had a great, great time talking. Next morning, we go to lead, and Oshkosh is IFR. We were going to stop at Oshkosh because that's where Lee's family was from. We needed an IFR chart. Well, somebody out in the country had one, and we drove out in the country, and he said, I'll let you have it, but you got to sign it and send it back. So we said, okay. So we flew to Oshkosh, and if you know, they are just wonderful to us there, and Lee, all these relatives came, probably 40 came to see Lee in his airplane, little kids and his, you know, nephews and everything. And I never saw this whole flight, I saw smiling faces around our airplane. And I think that's really a tribute to Lee and what he did. So then we take off to come back to Willow Run Airport. And it's raining again. It was raining when we left, raining when we got back. So I shot a full IFR approach right down the 200 and touched the wheel through up spray, of course. And here we are taxiing in. We are back. And we are back. And when I stepped out of that door, I didn't realize right then my life was going to change. I stepped out on the world stage, kind of, and went around and I shared this experience with so many people, and I'm glad I did, because if you're privileged to do something, you can share it. And I've gone vicariously with other people, and I think that's a nice thing to do, to share. And my husband's in the background, he's looking at me like, what's this now? But we had interviews, and we talked to them, and here we are, back. And Lee and Bill and me and Bill Payne, and we're right close to one of those great engines. Those engines were perfect. Start, run. They never missed a beat. Nothing went wrong with that airplane. Can you imagine? A 30-year-old plane restored, and we flew it around the world. I was never afraid, ever. I knew we had Lee, we had the plane, and we had a mission, so I knew we were okay. Well, then the next Saturday, Saline, Michigan, where we lived, had a Welcome Home Ann Day parade, and hey, they made that little sign. I was so thrilled. That's just, never had that before. And that was up for several years, of course, and they had to take it down. But that was outside the city for a long time. They had a parade that day. This is the day that Heidi mentioned, and Pellegrino Day, July 15th. It was a parade day in Saline and all over the state. And by that time, I'd been in the news so much, they just say Ann. They never bothered with the last name anywhere in the news. And here we all are, dressed in our best, in our convertible, and we got to ride down in front of everybody. And then we went to the reviewing stand and watched our own parade. That was kind of nice. Then I took the plane to Oshkosh. And Lee is letting us take the plane. There's no hull insurance on it or anything, but he trusted us with it. He'd say, okay, you can take it. You know, of course, I was very careful. The only thing I worried about was screwing up, but then I thought, no, the airplane's not going to let me down if I don't let it down, you know, so. And we were there for a week at Oshkosh. That old plane just stood there so patient, waiting for everybody to look at her. And that's the governor of Wisconsin. He came down to look, and he wanted to see everything in the fuselage. We had a wonderful visit. And then I took the plane to Ottumwa, Iowa, which is where the Antique Airplane Association had their annual fly-in. Now they've moved it to Blakesburg to a grass strip. But here we are, and there's that wonderful airplane. And, you know, those props. One time I said I really wanted to hug that airplane every night because, you know, he had done it. And I was given so many awards, so many, many awards. And I think that Ann Day certificate is there, Heidi, second from the left, that they gave me for Ann Appreciation Day. I think that's right, second from the left. And that's our fireplace. We rented a little house on a collective farm. There were six houses in a grove, and there were other houses. Gray Marine Engine owned it. Lovely out in the country. But when I received an award, oh, that little tiger, my high school kids had given me about $1,000 where I went to high school, wearing shorts for a day for a quarter. Now we got about $1,100 from them, and that's what we used for motels the first part of the trip. You know, we just skin of our teeth to finance it. And that little tiger was to keep a tiger in our tank. And so that went with us the whole time. That's the key to the city. That's the one I got from Celine when I gave a talk later that year. And I've never had a bigger key. Because most of them are little plastic boxes. This is a real key to the city. This is Miriam Morrissey, and this is right here in Atchison, the birthplace home. This is probably 1997 when they had the big 100th day birthday party for Amelia, and that was a weekend. Let me tell you, anybody who was here will never, ever forget it. It was just beautiful. Happy birthday, Amelia, 100 years old, you know. And there's Muriel, and we visited, and, you know, she would give us talk, and she would stand up there like she was at the prow of a ship, giving that talk, guiding her life and Amelia's so the audience could understand. I mean, she was amazing. Lee, I couldn't afford the plane. I mean, no way. And so he finally sold it to Air Canada. This plane, CFTCA, was manufactured in October of 37. Purchased by CFTCA, Trans-Canada Airlines, that's why it's TCA. Trans-Canada Airlines bought a second one later that year and another one early in 1938. And that was CFTCB and CFTCC. And they have all three of them now. TCC, they fly around with airline seats. It's nice, I've seen it. And anyway, TCA was their first passenger liner, really. And it was up in the terminal at Montreal or Ottawa, I can't remember which. My folks went to see it. They put it back like with the seats and the fishnet racks. I wanted to remember it like she was. But my folks went to see her and had a tour. They put the old two-position props on, and they put the logo on, the maple leaf there, and it was there for years until they built the new museum at Rockcliffe. And then they moved her over. And you know, She stood there, and she still looks like she wants to fly. And they had a stewardess, and they had the luggage. And I'm going to just leave that on a minute, because that airplane, and I'm sure, in that museum, in the quiet of the night, when all the humans had left, the last door latch had clicked, that those airplanes talked. And don't you think ours had a good story to tell?
Yes.
And I just think that airplane should be so proud of what she did. I mean, she was almost human. And they still have the other two. And in 1986, they took this airplane, they took it apart and took it to the Canadian Expo, right, Heidi?
In Vancouver.
In Vancouver it was, okay. And she was there all summer, basically. And she was had her prop spinning slowly and music of the 30s playing. Lee went over to see her, and he said it was very impressive. And so she had a trip again, went somewhere to talk about. Now, this is, you think that's the end of a talk, a sunset? It isn't. It's the sunrise, the dawn. And it's what we saw above the clouds heading toward Oakland after flying all night from Honolulu. And I like to think of it as the beginning of the day. It was the beginning of my going around and sharing this fantastic story, really, how he did it with people all over the country, young ones, old ones, anybody, you know. And after the bills were all paid, I never charged. I enjoy sharing it. And we sold the big photos that Champion Spark Plug had given us for 50 cents when the bills were paid, no. And I give away my flight covers now, as I have been. If you didn't get one, come up and get one. And so this 50th anniversary, I'm doing it for my crew. They're all gone now. They were about 10 years older than I was.
Thank
of course,
you for
I miss them, but I can think of them. All my animals,
podcast,
my crew, my family, they're all close to my heart.
Series.
And they'll always be there.
We hope you've enjoyed
but this
show.
Was the beginning of
come
sharing
back to Chasing
this with people like you
each
and
week
people
for
all over the
new
world.
Podcast.
Thank you.
While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Speak, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated. Chris Evan Films, Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated, and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.